Allow me to tell you a story about how I finally overcame my addiction to tobacco. In 1990, I decided that I could wait no longer. I simply had to quit smoking. I'd smoked since high school and had wanted to quit for years. But when my daughter Lucy came into my life, quitting smoking became imperative. I tried going cold turkey several times, and each time I relapsed. Then I went to a guru people in Boston called the Mad Russian. He hypnotized large audiences to help them quit smoking and had great results. While he had a stellar reputation and his hypnotic suggestions worked wonders for many people, the Mad Russian's efforts did nothing for me except lighten my wallet. Next, I went to see a behaviorist who guaranteed that I would quit as long as I followed his instructions to the letter. I am a sucker for guarantees. He instructed me as follows. You may smoke as much as you want to. However, for your next cigarette, you must put 1 cent into a special account to be donated to your favorite charity. For the next cigarette, 2 cents. And for the third, you pay 4 cents. The price doubles for each successive cigarette. Smoke as many as you like. Just double the price each time you light up a new one. If you do the arithmetic, you'll see that for my mere 30th cigarette, I'd be giving my charity $5,368,709.12. For obvious reasons, I was not able to follow the behaviorist's instructions. I felt ashamed. I felt like a bad person, an addict, a weak man, a lousy husband, and a lousy dad. Then I went to see an acupuncturist. I feared the needles, but I was willing to suffer whatever pain it took to quit. To my absolute astonishment, I loved the experience of getting stuck. The insertion of the filament-sized needles released an endorphin high. I would lie on the doctor's table and drift to sweet places, listening to soft music. I looked forward to my appointments and went religiously twice a week for 12 weeks. I loved acupuncture, but I didn't quit smoking. However, acupuncture whetted my appetite for getting that wonderful feeling the needles induced. I'd heard that both long-distance running and meditation could produce similar effects. Since I'm lazy, I was about as likely to learn Mandarin as take up long-distance running, so I thought I'd give meditation a try. Meditation worked. I quit smoking. I have not had a cigarette in over 20 years. Meditation. You have heard about the myriad benefits of meditation, that it can lower stress levels and blood pressure, increase energy and cognitive function, and make you calmer and happier. But meditation does much more than that. Aside from helping me give up my addiction to nicotine, meditation has helped people in other wondrous ways. Recent research has shown that it helps a person function better psychologically. People who struggle with anxiety, addiction, depression, and eating disorders have benefited from it. It can even enhance leadership skills. In a wonderful book called The Mindful Leader, Michael Carroll lays out a program to help executives develop their management skills through meditation. My hope here is not to repeat what is already well known, but to convince you to incorporate some meditative practices into your daily life, if you have not already done so, and then to offer resources where you can learn all you need to get started. When I suggest that someone try meditating, I usually hear objections like the following. Right, the person will say with a roll of the eyeballs. I know about meditation. I know it's an ancient practice. I know that smart people pay lots of money to go on retreats where they sit on cushions for days, even weeks, eating only water and grains. I know it would be good for me to do that too, just as a daily dose of wheatgrass juice would be good for me along with a 2-week cleanse. Sorry, but I'm just not up for it. I like hot dogs with mustard, and I like nachos with oozy yellow cheese, and I'd rather relax by watching TV than by meditating. Honestly, hell will freeze over before I take up meditation. I used to feel that way about flossing, and now I floss every day. I started flossing every day when I asked my dentist if I really did need to floss. He replied, "You only need to floss the teeth you want to keep." So I started flossing for real. I should do it twice a day, but I only do it once. On the other hand, I now meditate one or two times a day, not because I should, but because it feels so good. As an added benefit, I know it's really good for me. To my surprise, I like it so much that I've learned several different practices. The core of most meditative practices couldn't be simpler. You sit in a comfortable chair in a room free from distraction. You put both feet on the floor and both hands on the arms of the chair or place them comfortably on your lap. You then close your eyes and focus on your breathing. In, out. In, out. You watch your thoughts float by like leaves on a river. You try not to evaluate your thoughts, but rather let them pass by indifferently, without a comment or a care. You detach as much as you can from conscious engagement with anything other than your focus on your breathing and the disinterested watching of whatever passes through your mind. That's meditation. Most serious practitioners of meditation do it for stretches of 20 minutes or more. But if you just do it two or three times a day for as little as 3 to 5 minutes each time, you will feel better than you felt before. You will focus better, and your vital signs, blood pressure, heart rate, respiratory rate, and body temperature, will be lower. There are thousands of good books from which you can learn how to meditate. In addition to the one I already mentioned, which is aimed at managers, two others I recommend are Get Some Headspace, How Mindfulness Can Change Your Life in 10 Minutes a Day, by Andy Puddicombe, and The Mindfulness Prescription for Adult ADHD, by Lydia Zilowska, MD. You do not need to have ADHD to gain great benefit from this book. Not only are the methods recommended in both easy to implement, both programs have been carefully researched and proven to work to enhance the focus of anyone who uses them, as well as provide the many other health benefits of meditation. Stimulation. Just as meditating is good for both your body and your brain, mental stimulation confers various benefits as well. When you stretch your brain by trying new tasks or doing everyday tasks in ways you've never done them before, you are doing something that will not only enhance your ability to maintain focus, but also help stave off the ravages of aging, including dementia. One of the most obvious ways to stretch your brain is to take lessons in something that you've never done before. A friend of mine in her 50s who knew very little about music decided to take up piano. She told me that, in learning to read music, she felt as if her brain was on fire from the stimulation. Yet another friend, who has mastered several foreign languages, talks about the same feeling every time she learns a new one. You can also take courses for free on massive open online courses, MOOCs, taught by famous professors and offered through elite universities like Harvard, MIT, Johns Hopkins, and UC Berkeley. For a directory, go to www.moocs.com. Alternatively, you can go online and listen to an illuminating TED Talk. You can also go to one of the many online sites that serve as brain gyms, like Lumosity or NeuroNation, where you can give your brain a workout. You can also play various computer games to enhance various cognitive functions. For example, CogMed, which has a solid base of research, improves active working memory, the amount of data you can hold in your mind at one time and work with. If you play, it's actually hard work, CogMed for a half hour or so, 5 days a week, for 5 weeks, you are all but guaranteed to see a spike in active working memory. Or you can try the M-Wave from HeartMath. another product backed by research, the M-Wave reduces anxiety and promotes superior performance. In a recent New Yorker article, Patricia Marks wrote a highly informative and amusing review of these and similar products, while also reporting on her own experience using one of them, BrainHQ. While, as she put it, she didn't emerge smart enough to date Harold Bloom, she did both enjoy much of the experience and also derive significant benefits, which the founder of BrainHQ, Michael Merzenich, told her should last several years, after which she could slip back or sign up for another training. Of course, there are plenty of other ways to stretch your brain. If you've only driven cars with automatic shifts, try learning to drive a car with a manual transmission. If you're right-handed, try writing, or mousing, with your left hand. Or try drawing a circle with one hand, a square with the other hand, and triangles with both feet. This is not easy. Make a habit of challenging your brain and training your attentional systems. Here's one brain booster you can produce with the aid of your word processing program. Draw a grid with 25 boxes. Print it out, then put in the numbers 1 through 25 randomly, one in each box. Then, take a pen or pencil and, starting with 1, tap each number in sequence, 1 through 25, as fast as you can. Time yourself and then do it again, this time in reverse order, 25 down to 1. You can print out 10 such grids and fill numbers into a blank grid as soon as you've done the previous one enough times that you know where the numbers are. It's an excellent exercise for training attention and flexing your brain. Here's another exercise. Look at your desk, then look away. On a blank piece of paper, draw a replica of your desk that includes everything on it. You can make it more challenging by looking at a colleague's desk, then doing the same thing. Or at home, you can open a cupboard, stare inside for a minute, then close it and write down as many items as you can remember. John F. Kennedy used to play a game when he was waiting for a play to start or a plane to take off. Write down 7 random letters in a vertical column. Then across from each, write down 7 more random letters. Look at each pair of letters as a famous person's initials and fill in as many as you can. For example, FN might be Florence Nightingale, EC might be E.E. Cummings, and MM might be Marilyn Monroe. You can make this game tougher by trying to come up with a second name for each set of initials. Or you can make it really tough by adding a third column and come up with a first, middle, and last name. Of course, there are crossword puzzles and the loathsome Sudoku. I say loathsome because I'm so bad at those. There are a plethora of websites devoted to cognitive stimulation and brain training. How much is a plethora? A Google search for online cognitive stimulation sites yielded 6.4 million entries. On Amazon, Brain Games brought 8,038 titles, while Cognitive Stimulation brought up 2,267. Once you get the basic idea, though, it's fun to make up your own games. That, in itself, becomes a form of cognitive stimulation. Another powerful tool I use when I write is music. For years, I've listened to classical music while writing. My theory is that the music engages the part of my brain that would otherwise be distracting me. A British rock musician turned scientist of sound has taken that theory to a scientifically validated level. He has created music engineered not to engage the listener. Amazingly, if you listen to this music while, say, writing, your focus improves significantly. I now swear by it. I am listening to his music as I write these lines. If you want to try it, go to the website focusatwill.com. I predict you will be as impressed by it as I am. Chapter 10. harnessing the power of the human connection. The human connection is the most powerful force in the world for growth, health, fulfillment, and joy. At its most distilled, we call it love. As it spreads out, I call it connection, a feeling of being a part of something beneficent that is larger than oneself. As powerful as connection is, it is typically relegated to some sentimental bin, trivialized and dismissed as puny when compared to the supposedly more muscular drivers of excellence, like rigor, discipline, sacrifice, and, of course, hard work. While those always matter, they lose much of their power unless used in a context of connection. To cite Matthew Lieberman again, people often talk as if their company, job, or workplace is solely about getting a paycheck and helping the company increase profits. This conversation is predicated on the norm of self-interest, the belief that self-interest is the only thing that motivates people. We have been bombarded with this idea for so long that it's the only conversation we know how to have about the workplace. But it is the wrong conversation to be having because it misses so much of what actually makes us us. The conversation we ought to be having, that we are wired to be having, as Lieberman's research proves, is the conversation about connection. The forgotten key. Developing connections of various kinds, not only human, but inanimate as well, e.g. connection to a poem, to a favorite chair, to a meadow or a lake, to an idea or a creed, to a goal, to a tradition, is the cheapest, most effective step a person can take not only toward promoting mental clarity and focus, but toward promoting health, happiness, and productivity. It's that simple. Nothing in life produces more that is good than the force of connection. And nothing produces more misery than the force of disconnection. I call connection the other vitamin C, or vitamin connect. It is as essential for life as the first vitamin C, ascorbic acid. Without that vitamin C, people die of a disease called scurvy. Without vitamin connect, people suffer, and not just emotionally, but physically as well. Consider the case of the children who lived in orphanages during the reign of Romanian dictator Nicolae Ceausescu, who was ousted from power in 1989. Because birth control was outlawed, many parents gave up their unwanted children to horrible institutions where the children weren't coddled or cuddled. There weren't enough caretakers. All the children were forced to eat, bathe, and go to the toilet at the same time. Babies were left in wet diapers and developed terrible rashes. Kids who acted out were tied to their cribs, dozens to a room. Researchers later found that the brains of these children had less white matter, or the important fat-covered tracts between brain cell bodies, than those who went into foster care. Then think of what happens to prisoners, the elderly, the mentally ill, and others who suffer from a lack of vitamin connect. People lacking connection descend a slow slope into the process of dying, and they die a death that rarely is named for what it is. The cause of death listed on the death certificate is usually cancer, stroke, heart attack, infection, or some other proximate cause. But those diseases represent the final common pathway of a much longer, insidious process initiated by loneliness, depression, lethargy, and lassitude, all brought on by a feeling of disconnection. Lest you doubt that a lack of vitamin connect is fatal, consider the research of Lisa Berkman, a professor at the Harvard School of Public Health. Berkman led studies that rocked the world of academic medicine. First published in the 1970s, her research proved that social isolation poses as dangerous a risk factor for early death as cigarette smoking, obesity, or high blood pressure. At first, experts doubted the studies, But now, her findings have been replicated around the world and can be considered fact. The first social scientist to prove the link between isolation and mortality, Berkman confirmed what some ancient peoples already knew well, making banishment their most severe punishment, a punishment feared far more than death. Berkman continued her research to show the various problems that a lack of social supports poses to individual health and longevity. She found that social support must be of a certain quality to be effective. As she put it, for social support to be health-promoting, it must provide both a sense of belonging and intimacy, and must help people to be more competent and self-efficacious. The appeal of Vitamin Connect should be unmatched because it costs nothing, can never be depleted, and does more to improve life than any other single force. But people walk right past it, barely even noticing it, as if it were a beer bottle in the gutter. While the average person may trivialize the power of this vitamin C, smart organizations understand it. The software firm SAS, for example, urges employees to bring their spouse and kids to join them at work for lunch. The Atlanta, Georgia Housing Authority lowered the partitions between cubicles so people could see each other, which led to a major uptick in productivity and morale. The Harvard Chemistry Department saw a marked reduction in depression and suicide when it took steps to create a more connected culture. As I mentioned earlier, we live in a modern paradox of hyperconnection electronically, yet relative disconnection interpersonally. In their book, Connected, Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler report on their study of 3,000 randomly selected Americans. They set out to discover how many close social contacts people have, defining close social contacts as those people one discusses important matters with or spends free time with. They found that the average American has just 4 close social contacts, with most having between 2 and 6. Sadly, 12% of Americans listed no one. At the other extreme, 5% of Americans had 8 such people. Christakis and Fowler go on to explain some of the compelling and surprising findings emerging from the study of social networks. For example, one of the qualities of social networks is contagion, the tendency for various moods, habits, and practices to flow through groups of people and affect not just those who know each other, but even friends of friends of friends. After 3 degrees of influence, as the authors put it, the effect drops off. But most of us are quite unaware that what our friends' friends' friends feel, think, and do affects us in a significant way. This simple tendency for one person to influence another has tremendous consequences when we look beyond our immediate connections. So not only is it good for you to connect, but also to choose your friends wisely, knowing, of course, that you can't control whom your friends or your friends' friends may befriend. Since social networks tend to magnify whatever they are seeded with, be it joy and optimism, or obesity, depression, and violence, it is good to know as much as you can about the people you hang out with. The fact that positive energy is contagious and smiles are good for us has now been proven. Christakis and Fowler cite a study showing that when waiters were trained to offer service with a smile, their customers report feeling more satisfied and they leave better tips. Not only that, based on a study of 33 male professional cricket players fitted with computers that recorded their moods during a match, there was a strong association between a player's own happiness and the happiness of his teammates, independent of the state of the game. Further, when a player's teammates were happier, the team's performance improved. The science is conclusive. The practical question becomes, how can a person live a connected life? The good news is that it's quite simple, as long as you take it seriously. To give you an idea of how to do that, here's a practical 10-step plan outlining how you could get your daily dose of this amazing supplement, Vitamin Connect. Share a meal. Eat breakfast, dinner, or a midnight snack with someone every day. If you live alone, eat lunch with someone. Make a habit of having human moments, moments of in-person connection, rather than just electronic moments, throughout your day. Make time for making love. The most common sexual complaint I hear in my practice is that people don't make time for sex. If you have a partner, make time for sex. Sex is good for you in every measurable way, and every immeasurable way as well. It is impossible to be depressed, cynical, sad, upset, or in any other way less than fully alive while you're having an orgasm. Have many. Keep photographs of people, pets, and places you love in your wallet or purse, and, if possible, in and around your work site. Look at them frequently. Never worry alone. At least, not for an extended period of time. When you get worried for more than a little while, call someone, meet someone for coffee, or go to someone else's office. Pick the logical person to worry with, given the topic that's on your mind. When you worry alone, your worry quickly turns toxic. You become frozen in fear and your IQ plummets. When you connect with another person, you immediately feel less vulnerable and more powerful, even though the situation you're worried about hasn't changed at all. However, your ability to deal with it skillfully has skyrocketed. Go outdoors at least once a day in addition to your commute. Commune, as they used to say, with nature. Drink nature in. Gaze up at the sky and let awe fill you. A blue sky with a cloud or two and sunshine is even better than gin with vermouth and a twist. Allow your mind to absorb the miraculous mental nutrients that radiate from nature, free of charge, albeit highly charged. Own a pet. Pets are grandmasters at providing Vitamin Connect. If you can't own a pet, try to associate with animals in any way you can. Most animals have solved the riddle of life, and they are eager to show you what they know. Let them. Freud himself owned a dog, a chow chow named Jaffe, whom he adored. He kept her in the consulting room during his psychoanalytic sessions because he believed she calmed his patients. Develop a best friend at work. Cultivate this relationship as much as you can, even if it cuts into your work time. Over time, the force of that friendship will more than pay for itself in increased productivity and desire to come to work. Having a best friend at work gives you something to look forward to on Monday morning. No matter how badly work may be going, such a friendship gives you someone to worry with, as well as someone with whom to have fun and celebrate success. Opt out of office politics. As delicious and seductive as they can be, resist indulging in the tantalizing treats of gossip, backbiting, and office politics as much as you possibly can. Often marvelously fun and engrossing in the moment, they turn work sour over time and inevitably exert a disconnecting influence on the culture you work in. Make time for friends and family away from work. And please, do it now, before it's too late. As a psychiatrist, one of the most painful laments I hear, and I hear it often, is, "Why didn't I do it when I could?" The gravest and most common mistake a dedicated worker makes is to set too low a priority on what he or she does away from work, especially with friends and family. You can't keep up close ties with all your friends, and you can't devote infinite time to your family. But you can commit enough time to keep those connections sufficiently lively that you look forward to them as the revitalizing reward in your life they ought to be. join an organization outside of work, from which you derive great satisfaction and to which you make a valuable contribution. It may be a dinner club, or a basketball or soccer team, or an acting company. It may be a church, synagogue, or other religious group. It may be a chorus, a book group, an equestrian club, or a political group. Just find some organization that means a lot to you, that you derive fun from, and that you believe in enough to make time for. Although Vitamin Connect is all around wonderful, I offer a few important caveats. As much as connection is such a force for good, it can also be destructive. Just look at the intense connections within gangs, or Mao's Communist Party, the Nazis in World War II, or the followers of Osama bin Laden. So deep and strong is the human need to connect, if a person does not find it in a healthy form, he will find it in a dangerous, sometimes evil form. While readers of this book are not going to join gangs or become terrorists, we all must be careful of whom we choose to trust. While I advise people never to worry alone, I also advise them to choose with care the person they worry with. I am a trusting person. Too trusting, in fact. I've been hurt by putting my trust in someone I took to be an ally, even a dear friend, only to have that person viciously stab me in the back. The instance I am referring to occurred in my business life, so I chalk it up to the cost of doing business. Nonetheless, it hurt me deeply and still causes me considerable distress when I think of it. Still, when you find the right person to worry with, that person can become a godsend. My best friend, Peter Metz, is my go-to guy. We've been playing squash together on Tuesdays for 30 years. After our games, we go out for a drink and share our concerns as well as our joys. Those times with Peter save my life over and over. Frame your problem so your friend can help you. Think of Les, the man with the electronics addiction. Let's say he goes to have a conversation with his friend Joe and says, "I really need help with what's become my internet addiction. I have a real problem. Can I talk to you about it?" Just the act of talking about it, exploring it, and letting the other person listen and react provides major assistance. Les could say, "I don't want or expect you to give me solutions. Please, just listen and help me ask questions. Don't think that I'm burdening you with solving my problem. I just want you to listen and react." This gives the other person permission to do the same thing with you, so you can help each other and deepen your connection. It's a process you don't have total control over, but must trust. When you do it, a lot gets going in your unconscious. Solutions and new behaviors will emerge as if out of nowhere. As I've said, you should create your own set of steps, your own action plan to fill your life with Vitamin Connect. Among the sensational six, this step is the most rewarding and the easiest to implement, and will surprise you the most with its extraordinary benefits. Our greatest joy and satisfaction lie in achievement and in intimacy, in work and in love. Try to focus on both and not let one take over your life. Nothing beats it. In addition to Vitamin Connect, there is another important thing that can improve your psychological health. I have a friend whose father had 11 heart attacks over 10 years and died at the age of 62. He was a hard-driving man who drank too much and suffered greatly in his life, which took a toll on his health. In the end, his heart was only about as strong as a rabbit's. He had difficulty getting out of bed in the morning, putting on his clothes, and going out to the hammock on the patio, where he spent his day lying under an orange tree, looking at the blossoms, smelling them, and gazing at the blue sky filtered through the shiny leaves. He was grateful for that, because in the end, that's all he had. When I told my friend about Vitamin Connect, she said, "You ought to add to that vitamin G, which is gratitude." There is solid empirical validation for my friend's placement of such a high value on vitamin G. In George Valiant's longitudinal studies of which factors make for the most successful adaptations to life, gratitude ranks right at the top. It doesn't matter that much what your lot in life is, but rather how you feel about your lot in life, an opinion you can control perhaps more than you realize. Or, as a rabbi once put it, happiness is not having what you want, but wanting what you have. Field work, energy management through the day. If you've done the prep work and made full use of the sensational six practices, then the daily maintenance of energy will be far easier for you. But you can't expect your energy supply to be constant throughout the day. Therefore, it makes sense to find your own individual rhythm. When do you feel most energetic, most able to do difficult work? And when do you typically feel dull? Some people attend better with music playing, while walking around, or with someone else sitting in the room. Some people focus better in the morning, at night, in warm rooms, or in cold. Some need caffeine, others a hot shower. Some people focus in quick bursts, while others do their best working for long stretches, then resting for a day, or even two. One size does not fit all. Simply try to notice what works best for you. Plan accordingly. Don't shoot your wad. Conserve your best energy for your most significant work. I'm at my best, for example, when I first arrive at work. It's what I call my morning burst. Many people are like me. If you are, then be careful not to waste your morning burst by getting buried in email. Email is a time suck. Unless there is something urgent that you absolutely must attend to, don't waste your precious energy. You don't want your morning burst to turn into your morning bust. Save your energy for the most demanding, most important tasks of the day. But try to operate within your basic patterns, your basic rhythms, rather than fighting them and always trying to modulate them. Not only is it important to monitor your use of energy throughout the day, but also throughout the week, the month, the year. In this way, you can anticipate when you will work hard, and your mind and body can prepare for that, while you can also subconsciously know when you will not need to be on. Chapter 11. Harnessing the Power of Emotion. At the Phillips Exeter Academy in New Hampshire, where I went to high school, there was a legendary wrestling coach named Ted Seabrook. He influenced thousands of students, most notably the novelist John Irving, through his coaching and his example. One of his memorable coaching axioms was, "Where the head goes, the body must follow." I adapt Seabrook's axiom here and say, "Where the heart goes, effort follows." We work hardest for what we care about most. People will work 16-hour days at jobs they hate in order to make money for what they love, their family. Emotion motivates us like nothing else. Too often, people assume they can, or should, operate at their best no matter what kind of mood they're in. If we were all like Star Trek's Mr. Spock, then mood would not matter. But since none of us is Vulcan, mood matters far more than most people take into account. From school through every job we ever have, one of the most discriminating factors dictating our performance is how we feel while we are doing what we do. Emotion impeded the progress of the characters we met in Part 1. Les tried to escape the emotions of everyday life through his blitzed-out screen-sucking. Jean grew angry and impatient at feeling that she was being taken advantage of, which in turn retarded her efforts. Ashley's inability to focus on one thing led her to become frustrated with herself. Her husband was close to the end of his rope as well. The combination of their frustrations reduced her ability to do anything well. Jack became a slave to his worrying. Mary cared so deeply about everyone else that she lost her ability to care for herself and her family. And Sharon lived in a state of ongoing negative emotion because she felt that she was underachieving, which led her to underachieve all the more. Positive emotion is key to peak performance. Extreme fear sharpens focus in the short term, but it subsides out of physiological necessity. Fear can't last long before it turns to something else. Fatigue, numbness, or awareness of the danger without emotion attached. The supply of neurotransmitters, the electricity, if you will, required to sustain extreme fear simply runs out after a short while. Of course, fear remains a part of everyday life. At its best, it serves as a warning signal. But at its worst, it gets in the way and causes us to self-sabotage. As my old friend, the late great learning specialist Priscilla Vail, said to me many times, emotion is the on-off switch for learning. If you are angry, anxious, or otherwise upset, the negative emotions short-circuit your focus on whatever you are doing. You focus more on how bad you feel or what's making you feel bad than on the work you want to do. As Mary discovered, toxic emotion makes focus impossible. You can't compose a symphony, say, and carry on an argument simultaneously. Either you work on your symphony or you fight your fight, but you can't do both at once. If you are focusing on a spreadsheet and a colleague walks up to you with a magnum and says, "I am going to blow your brains out because you stole my best idea, you rat bastard," you will not be able to continue to work on your spreadsheet. It's physically impossible. Even if you disarmed your irate colleague and sent him off handcuffed in the custody of the police, you would be so shaken that it would be hours, if not days, weeks, months, or even years, before you'd be able to concentrate fully on any spreadsheet again. On the other hand, if you were working on that same spreadsheet and the same colleague came up to you and said, "Thanks for that nod of the head you gave me in the meeting yesterday. You have no idea how much I needed that," you'd feel renewed energy and focus, having just been given a dose of Vitamin Connect. This is because, in the brain, emotion rules. Deep within the brain are primitive centers that control the rest of the cerebrum. They've been in control for millions of years. These centers were elected to run the show in the brain early in evolution because they could protect us from danger far better than the fancy centers higher up in the cortex. When these deep centers were jockeying for control, the cortex didn't even exist, let alone make its way to the top. Nature, no fickle force, still retains its power in the deep centers, where primitive emotions can prevail over reason and hijack the mind, making it impossible to concentrate on anything but the toxic emotions. Negative emotions like fear, anger, depression, the desire for revenge, or feeling wronged shanghai the mind and cause us to do stupid things, say things we regret later, and alienate people who would otherwise be helpful to us. Not only does emotion influence focus and performance, it also affects health. However, the link isn't simple. We were once told that the type A personalities, the hard-driving competitive person, usually male, are at greater risk for heart attacks than the calmer type Bs. But that conclusion collapsed when studied closely. Then, we courted the type C personality, who was supposedly at greater risk for cancer. That notion perished under scrutiny as well. Now we have type D. For the past 20 years, Dr. Johan Dennelet and his team in the Netherlands have studied adults who score high on negative affect and social inhibition. Dennelet calls them type D for distressed. His research correlates having type D personality with greater risk of heart disease and slower recovery time. If you'd like to assess yourself, and who doesn't? We all love self-assessment quizzes. Visit www.health.harvard.edu/newsweek/type_D_4_distressed.htm. If you are a type D personality, if you are chronically distressed, your risk of heart attack increases and your recovery time slows. It also means that you have greater trouble focusing than the average person, and you are more likely to self-sabotage. Fortunately, there are many constructive steps you can take to tackle the problem. Pretty much every piece of advice in this book aims to reduce stress in your life so that you can perform at your best. So if you follow the tips throughout the book and retake the test in a month or two, your score will likely have changed. A few mental tricks to clear your mind. The old days of the tyrannical boss or sadistic teacher are fast coming to an end. Not because being a tyrant or a sadist is cruel or politically incorrect, but because tyrants and sadists fail. They don't get the best out of their people, or themselves for that matter. Unhappy people underperform, while people who love what they're doing surpass their personal best all the time. If your mind is clear of negative emotions, then you are able to focus on the work without distraction. Listen to the sidebar, Quick Tips for Managing Personal Psychology. Since negative emotion can shatter focus, and does so frequently, look at yourself and consider for a moment that you may be misinterpreting a given situation. A little self-awareness could go a long way to help you clear yourself of clouds of negative feelings and beliefs. We often create problems for ourselves and misinterpret reality by using psychological defense mechanisms that do not serve us well. Projection is common, so beware of it. In projection, you attribute to another person the feelings and beliefs you yourself hold. Projection is what drives paranoia. The paranoid person feels that people are out to get her because she is projecting her own aggressive feelings onto other people. Actually, they are not out to get her. She is out to get them. But she can't tolerate owning that feeling. She disowns it by projecting it onto others and wildly misreading reality. Paranoia is common in everyday life. The extreme version, the violent, psychotic, paranoid person, is rare. But most people lapse into moments of paranoia now and then. It is good to catch yourself before you make stupid decisions based on projection. Furthermore, paranoid feelings are hugely distracting and can preoccupy you all day, all week, sometimes all year. The ability to test your reality and snap out of a paranoid position can be a godsend. Another common defense mechanism that gets us into trouble is denial. Also a primitive defense, like projection, denial leads us not to see what's right in front of us. We deny it, usually, because we don't know how to deal with it. Of course, by denying a problem, we only allow it to worsen. Like projection, denial is also common. A good guard against it is to invite people to tell you your foibles, insist that others speak up when they see something you don't, and never punish anyone for being honest with you, no matter how much you may not like to hear what they have to say. A third common defense mechanism that can get you into trouble is reaction formation, which I discussed in relation to toxic handlers like Mary in Chapter 5. When using reaction formation, you express the opposite of what you actually, unconsciously, feel. This explains why many people behave in a way opposite to their best interests, why they stay with a bad job or bad boss, why they accept substandard pay, why they allow others to take credit for work they've done, or why they accept abuse without protest. Such people have enormous trouble acknowledging anger, sticking up for themselves, or being what they feel is selfish. Unlike the paranoid person who projects his anger, the person using reaction formation turns the feeling into its opposite before it reaches consciousness. The best way to deal with this is to ask yourself, "Why do I put up with this?" Or listen when a caring colleague asks you the same question. When you get feedback from others that you are getting a raw deal, try not to play the martyr, as if that were somehow noble, but instead have a talk with yourself, or someone else, to get in touch with sane and useful feelings of aggression and self-assertion. As I've stated throughout this book, the art of sustaining focus depends on many tricks, not the least of which is understanding yourself psychologically and knowing where your blind spots might be. Shakespeare's King Lear lost his focus on how much his daughter, Cordelia, truly loved him because he fell prey to his desire to be loved and worshipped beyond possibility. Cordelia's sisters gave their father the insincere, flattering words he craved when Cordelia spoke the truth, that she loved him but would not sully that love in an insincere trumpeting of it. Lear banished her and set in motion his tragic downfall, as well as hers. Lear lost focus on that most important of all objects of focus, the truth, because his insatiable need to be worshipped blinded him to the true love his daughter felt for him. How many bosses do you know like that? How many have you worked for? It seems the more power a person acquires, the less able he or she becomes to hear hard truths. How many managers fail to grow as much as they could because they can't handle the truth, to quote the famous line from A Few Good Men. Staying focused requires an ability to handle truth. Handling the truth requires an ability to know your weak spots psychologically. If, for example, Lear had been able to say, "As I grow older and closer to death, I feel a growing need for love and reassurance to give me the courage to face the end of my reign and of my life," then he would have avoided losing everything, including the daughter who loved him most. Quick tips for managing personal psychology. As I've stated, while technology has spawned one part of the problem, a person's individual psychology makes a major contribution as well. Part of learning to manage modern life depends on learning to manage our own emotions and hang-ups. Nothing distracts a person more than being in emotional distress. To help you get a handle on that part of the picture, your personal psychology, here are some quick tips to help you manage your own psyche better. 1. Work with your emotional grain, not against it. For example, if you like groups, work in groups and avoid being alone too much. On the other hand, if you like privacy and solitude, create structures that allow you to work on your own and not in groups too much. If you like to take chances, but if you don't, don't. If you get upset in the presence of conflict, be a peacemaker. On the other hand, if you like to fight, work in an arena where that's an asset, such as in certain kinds of law or entrepreneurism. It's the most revered and most time-tested of all wisdom, put in different ways by the ancient Greeks, the Bible, the Torah, and Shakespeare. First know yourself, then be true to yourself. 2. Try to identify your hot buttons. What particularly annoys you? Is it a know-it-all? Is it someone who interrupts? Is it someone who won't ever say please or thank you? Is it someone who is obsequious? Someone who kisses up? Someone who's so PC, she or he is a hypocrite? Is it a name dropper? A blowhard? A pedant? Try to name the hot buttons you know in advance will set you off more than they set off most people. Then, when you see one coming, either get out of the way, i.e. leave the area, or suck it up and say to yourself, I am not going to let this put me in a bad mood and ruin my workday. I am going to control my response and control the craziness within me that this person triggers. 3. Play armchair psychologist with yourself. Look back into your childhood, asking, what issues came up then that carry through to today? These issues are usually obvious. However, they may not be obvious to you, because we don't like to see painful matters, even if they are clear to everyone else. So, let someone you trust and who knows you well walk you through it. Are you a workaholic because your father was and you want to please him or outdo him? Are you insecure because you never got the unconditional love you needed early on? Are you ruthlessly competitive because you felt you always had to do it on your own? Are you unable to trust anyone because one of your parents betrayed you in a fundamental way? Were you the one who had to take care of your siblings because your parents, for whatever reasons, couldn't? And now you can't give up the habit of taking care of everyone. If you can identify these big, obvious issues, you can use insight and practice to overrule them. You can cease repeating the same mistake over and over, and in so doing, radically improve your focus on what matters most. Childhood issues can Shanghai focus 24/7. A little insight can go a long way to empowering you to overrule those tendencies and hang-ups that are rooted in the past. 4. Know what turns you on. I don't mean sexually. Of course, it's good to know that for other contexts. I mean what turns you on work-wise. What do you love to do? For a surgeon, it's performing surgery. For an entrepreneur, it's making a deal that turns a big profit. For a teacher, it's helping a struggling student suddenly understand. For a writer, it's writing a good sentence. Just as emotion can turn off peak performance, it can also turn it on. Know what turns you on. Then do that as much as you can. 5. Seek and accept help. Consider that someone else might know something you don't and may have insight that you could value. The people who make the biggest messes of their lives, and in my line of work I get to see many messes, are the people who refuse to listen to anyone else, who say, it's my way or the highway, and who romance their own point of view to the point of choosing to fail rather than succeed by trying someone else's way. It's one thing to march to the beat of your own drummer, but quite another to block out all other instruments. Another piece of the foundational wisdom of Western culture, pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall, is just one of its best-known expressions. It underpins almost every tragedy ever written, from the Greeks to Shakespeare to Herman Melville and Arthur Miller. Far worse than being a distraction, stubborn pride totally blinds a person. C state versus F state. The sensational six practices will go a long way toward helping you balance your emotions, but there are times when you will still feel spent, tired, foggy, or irritable. You will find yourself moving from what I call C state, cool, calm, collected, careful, curious, courteous, caring, consistent, concentrated, into what I call F state, fearful, fatigued, feeble, frantic, forgetful, frustrated, feckless, fractious, flaky, and about to utter another F word. You should have a file in your mind of instant interventions, because if you stay in F state for long, you can do a ton of damage to your work and to yourself. In F state, people sabotage their good work. As you